The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com. The Fern Line is also supported by the Moose's Tooth Pub and Pizzeria. Moose's Tooth has been a hub of the Anchorage community since 1996, offering a great selection of mouth-watering pizzas and salads, award-winning handcrafted beers, and incredible live concerts. I mean, what's better after a long day of skiing or climbing than talking about it with your friends over a backpacker pizza and a pitcher of Fairweather IPA? Not much. To peruse the menu or find out more about upcoming live events, check the Moose's Tooth out online at moosestooth.net.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On season two, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I've been immersing myself in some new creative projects yet again this last month, and it's actually a relief to take a break and dig back into this podcast that I love so much. Before we dive in, I want to remind folks that if you enjoy this show, there's a few ways you can really help out. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. You can share links via social media or text or email. You can tell someone directly. Tell your friends, your climbing partners, your family and coworkers, people you think might dig the Fern Line. Let them know it's out there. And if you really love this podcast, if the Fern Line adds value to your life, you might consider becoming a monthly backer on Patreon. Patreon backers get exclusive access to merchandise, bonus content, and music I write and produce. But more than anything, when you become a monthly backer on Patreon, you're supporting this show from the ground up and ensuring that this podcast remains a sustainable and viable endeavor for me moving forward. To find out more about becoming a monthly backer, just head on over to thefernline.com and click Support the Fern Line. If you want to get in touch, you can email me directly at thefernline@gmail.com. I love hearing from all of you, and I truly enjoy that added connection with my listeners. So please reach out and say hello. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or rickety chairlift and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
Thank you.
On this episode of The Fern Line, we'll get to know legendary backcountry skier Noah Howell. In an epic career spanning over 20 years, Howell has established himself as one of North America's most prolific and enduring backcountry masters. Call me old-fashioned or behind the times, but the one who got the ass shaking every night was Elmo James. From an early life-changing experience in the Alps, through a decade-long run of creativity at the helm of the infamous Powder Horror Productions, to a span of big mountain descents in Alaska, culminating in a recent ski descent of Mount Hunter's West Ridge, Howell continues to push the limits of what's possible in the mountains. I recently got to sit down with Howell for an engaging conversation about his life in and out of the mountains. We started our conversation by talking about his roots in Utah and how that led to his first experiences skiing in the Wasatch and eventually to the bigger mountains of Alaska.
Dust my broom, sweep the floor, the waitress just danced out the door, the boss man said, she had to catch a midnight train.
I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and good Mormon family. We didn't really do outdoors, so I didn't really grow up in that. We did have a cabin that we'd go to on occasion and do a little cross-country skiing, which was fun. I really enjoyed that, but we didn't do much. So it wasn't until much later, junior high, I started skiing. And that experience was, you know, at resorts on groomed runs and just going fast, way, you know, much faster than we should have for our ability. But that was fun. But I didn't really discover powder and kind of really fall in love and get hooked until after high school, when I started working at Deer Valley Ski Area, of all places. Got a job there, and that's where I started skiing powder, and just everything kind of changed there. So got a late start, but been trying to make up for it since.
I guess thinking back onto that time, did you have like a light bulb moment, or was there a time in your life where you were like, oh man, this is going to be who I am, and this is going to be what I do?
I think so. Or I knew it's what I wanted to do, and I fit in with who I thought I wanted to be. And once I found backcountry skiing, that more so than resort skiing, because that added the extra element of exploration and self-reliance and meditation and kind of a spirituality to me that was missing from the resort action. So it kind of was a nice intro. First found the powder and got hooked and learned the skill of the turn, and then started getting into the backcountry to get the full spectrum of what I enjoy today and what I've been doing pretty consistently and committedly for the last 20 years.
Thinking back kind of more into your early skiing life, who were some of the influences and some of the people that you looked up to in the skiing world?
Yeah, so I had my buddies that I actually got out with, and Todd Stewart and Daryl Finlayson, Kurt Soule, some local backcountry skiers that took me out into the backcountry. And one of my first days was a 2-foot powder day in Cardiac Bowl, which is kind of our big, perfect, pristine powder runs. And so that was pretty life changing. And hanging out with those guys and admiring their lifestyle, my one buddy Todd Stewart, you know, lived in a shack that he built on an old mining claim. And I just thought that was so cool, because after high school, I was kind of fell off track, I guess you'd say, and realized I didn't want to go and, you know, get a job and do a 9-to-5 and go to school. And so those guys kind of became my heroes in the flesh. And then I was reading up on alpinism and ski mountaineering, and Andrew McLean at that point had published his book, The Shooting Gallery. And I didn't know him, but that was really influential. And I was a big fan of ski films, so I was a Jeremy Nobis fan, and kind of wanted to combine those two. I was like, I want to go hike into the real big mountains, not with a helicopter, but like be able to rip that stuff like Nobis, and kind of have all those skills and be like a full, well-rounded skier. But Mark Twight and his writings were influential, kind of started, I don't know how you'd say it, just kind of trying to sharpen the spear and turn my body into a tool where I could go out and perform and do these things kind of in an alpinist style, as well as you know, not just skiing, but the climbing aspect.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of Mark Twight, obviously there is a climbing and an alpinism element to what you do. But back then, were you doing any just specific climbing separate from skiing?
No, it was really, really just climbing to ski. I don't have much of a climbing background because I'm usually trying to ski into June and then it's too hot here and then usually traveling a bit in the fall. So no, the climbing wasn't a big part of it, but the mentality or looking at the mountains in the winter that way, and even though it's not as extreme, just approaching them that way with that respect and with that, those, some of those ideals.
What are a couple trips or lines that you skied that really stick out to you as far as like maybe from your early career?
Yeah, there was, you know, I started on Telemark skis, leather boots and 3-pin bindings and 210 skis. So you couldn't really ski steeps well. It was really challenging. So we just were kind of skiing powder bowls. And then it was in that transition where Shooting Gallery came out and we were getting stiffer, beefier Telemark gear where we could do more. That was an influential time or cool period where we started taking more steep lines. I can remember vividly the hypodermic needle where you're just, you know, really pushing your own personal limit of like, can we make this turn? Can I do this? Is this, and then you get down and you know, you've kind of grown as a skier and kind of looking for the next steep thing. Also my first trip, one of my first expeditions was to Denali. And that was huge back in 2005. I got invited with some friends last minute. I actually didn't know them that well, just kind of community guys in the community that I knew of. And we had an incredible trip, got along really well. And so that was my first expedition and into the big mountains. That was incredible too.
Can you talk a little bit about that trip?
Yeah. So it was local guys, one of them worked at the Black Diamond retail store and they kind of knew of me and invited me along, and I was hesitant because I kind of like to do things with people I know, but we just clicked and we were a tight run ship and we just had great weather, good times. One of my buddies forgot toilet paper, so we traded, but he did bring a big thing of cookie dough, so I traded him toilet paper for cookie dough.
Nice.
And we got along great. We decided to try and we wanted to ski the Messner, but it was just blue ice when we arrived at 14.
Yeah.
But the Orient Express looked pretty good. So we did an acclimatization up to 18,000 feet and skied that in really good snow. Then the winds came and scoured it. And on our summit day and our ski day, it was a little wind, quite wind affected to the fact that it would break a little bit on you. But incredible summit up there at like 9 o'clock in the PM, no one else around. Just
beautiful.
Yeah, there's nothing like, it's like being on the moon, really. Yeah. It is. And unfortunately, one of my buddies fell in the Orient and,
Oh, man. Yeah,
we worked through the steep crux and then it was mellowing out and he kind of opened it up and was skiing a little aggressively. His skis punched through and he went over the handlebars and tumbled for a couple hundred feet from what we could see. And then he went around the corner and I mean, we thought he was dead. No question in our minds. So I raced off after him and my buddy yelled at me. He's like, hey, he's like, slow down. He's like, he's dead. And so we took our time, got around the corner and he was walking down to 14 camp. He was just fine. Yeah. Yeah. So that was one of the most intense days going from, you know, the amazing summit to, wow, our friend just died to, wow, our friend's just fine to, oh, now we got to carry his shit off the mountain for him.
God.
Yeah, so that was intense.
That sounds intense.
Yeah.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit. So in doing my research, you've written that Hansari was a huge influence on your outlook on what was possible skiing in the mountains. What lessons did you learn from Hans, and maybe talk a little bit how his death impacted you?
I was full bore. You know, I was 100% in. It's like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to be a ski mountaineer. I'm going to ski as much as possible. I'm going to work all summer so I can take the winters off. Like I was in, I was fully obsessed. And Hans was, you know, a hero. I hadn't met him before, but I followed him online and he was doing what, you know, the stuff I wanted to be doing and pushing steep skiing and exploring cool new areas. And I got to meet him in Chamonix when he was there with the North Face trip and Chris Erickson and Mark Holbrook. And that was huge because, you know, we went to the park at night with those guys and they were doing pull-ups and doing ladders. And I couldn't even probably do two pull-ups and they're just like doing one arm lock off, you know, all this stuff. So super impressed when I could, but he was really fired up to be there and in the motherland of steep skiing. And we rode the tram with him the day that he died. And that just really was a slap in the face of the reality of what the steep skiing game is and how quickly and easily it can get out of hand. So that was huge for me. I feel like I grew up a lot on that and reined things in because it's part of the fun is the imagination, you know, letting that run wild and the creativity and like, wow, I bet we could ski this or what if we could ski this? And you really have to balance that with conditions for the day and what have we seen and we got to climb that line first or rappel in and just making the right calls is such a tricky game in that way. So that was unfortunate that that happened, and but that was big for me.
One of the best parts about climbing or skiing, or any mountain sport for that matter, is the merging of creativity with your endeavor of choice. For some, it might be writing, others, painting. For a select few, well, it's podcasting. And for others like Noah Howell, filmmaking. In the mid-2000s, Noah and his brother Jonah, along with Andy Jacobson and Andy Rosenberg, started making backcountry ski films under the moniker of Powder Horror Productions. Known for their real-deal, do-it-yourself ethic and low-budget feel, the Powder Horror films built a cult-like following by combining unique characters and lowbrow humor with incredible and bar-setting backcountry ski footage. I asked Noah to talk about his memories of the Powder Horror film years, the ups and downs of the ski film touring life, and the legacy the films leave on the backcountry ski community. Somewhere somebody's coming home to find their lover gone. Tired and hungry, baby, looking for a home.
Yeah, so Powder Horror was a club, I would say, in the beginning, and it was like four or five, six of us that worked at Deer Valley, and we liked to backcountry ski, and you know, we had couple of days off a week. So we'd meet up in the evening before our days off and we'd drink beers and talk about where to go. I mean, that was back when the Wasatch was all new to me. So it was really fun and cool to look over maps and daydream about where we're going to go and then go explore new places. So then I started competing on the free skiing tour for telly, which was actually a thing back then. We get like 180 to 100 dudes showing up, throwing down. It was pretty cool. It was a really fun time. And there was a whole circuit. There was a comp in Jackson Hole, Crested Butte, Alpine Meadows, and here at Brighton. And so I started doing the tour and I met up with other guys that were ripping hard on telly skis and wanted to start filming and capturing what we were doing. So Andy Jacobson and Andy Rosenberg, they teamed up with my brother Jonah and I, and that's kind of when we took it from the club that it was to like a production company. And there was a couple of years where that's all we would do every day. We'd go out with our cameras and we'd take turns skiing a line. And then it was your turn to film and you'd just come down and swap out and then go boot up another line. And that was cool because we'd ski a little bit at Snowbird too. So skiing improved and those guys were really good. And trying to keep up with them was for the skiing, and then bringing them into the backcountry was cool because we could find untouched terrain and unique places and just kind of have the place to ourselves. We put together a couple little videos and they went not viral back then. I don't know. they got seen in the telly community and people were excited. So we started wondering, hey, maybe we could make this into something and put together an hour-long film, took it on tour. I think we did like five or seven cities our first year, and we just roll in with projector, no idea if anybody's going to show up. And
it's awesome.
It was fun. It was really fun. You know, just small crowds, but people were fired up and dedicated, because there wasn't anything like that kind of being shown for Telmark and backcountry skiers. Yeah. And yeah, kind of went from there.
That's so cool. When did you realize that, holy cow, like this is really resonating with people, and like we could actually turn this into a thing and, you know, maybe like help fund our lives doing this? What was that transition like?
that was never the thought. We knew it would never fund. I guess that's not true. It did fund our lives for a few years there. But what was fun is I got the camcorder from my dad because he bought it so we could videotape family events, and that never happened. So it was just kicking around. So I decided to take it out into the backcountry, and that was kind of where it first kicked off. I just couldn't believe people weren't out doing this. Like, right. It's right here in your backyard and no one is doing this. I still, it blows me away how few people go play in the mountains in the winter. It's just, So I wanted to capture that and bring it down to people that like weren't getting it. It was fun to try and share it. And then people were fired up. So that was cool. And I didn't care about money. I didn't think, you know, it would be a, you know, blockbuster, but I didn't care. I loved doing it. So I wanted to do it. And luckily I was able to talk my brother Jonah into it. He's like, there's just not the money here. And I'm like, well, come on then and help out, you know, and maybe we can make this work. And so, yeah, between the two of us, we made it work, but it was a lot of risk and a lot of time and a lot of effort. We called it like full-time work for part-time paycheck.
Well, yeah. Welcome to the club that we're all in.
right. Yeah. And it was about the passion and love of doing it. And the rest was, okay, yeah, we do have to, you know, we can't do this for free forever. We did for the first several years for sure, but
yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. It supported itself, and that was our goal. We're like, as long as this supports itself, and the people want to see this and buy this, then we'll keep going. So it's a good 10-year run. And
yeah, so when you look back at those series of films, what's the one film that stands out to you that you can look back on and you're the most proud of for whatever reason?
It's hard to watch them. My girlfriend likes to watch them. I can't stand it. I just like cringe. Except for our last few, I was really proud in a production standpoint of our last few films. But a couple stick out. Television to me was really fun, where we were able to add, I always kind of wanted it to be like part Saturday Night Live, part Warren Miller, you know, and a little more real and rough and raw, like the experience that I'm having out there, instead of so many companies were trying to polish their films so much that it doesn't even feel real or so, you know, we like to swear, we like to make stupid jokes and show a lot of skinning. I think we showed more skinning in our films than any other ski movies ever.
Yeah.
But that's what we're out there doing. So television was fun because we kind of started every segment in a fun way and made up mock, you know, television shows and had a lot of fun there. And then, you know, we kind of switched from just Telemark to backcountry, and that really felt much better to me. Telemark's such a strange little, it's almost like a religion, whereas if you're not in, you're out, and they're just proselytizing how much better it is. And that always bugged me, because like, hey, it's different. There are things I like about it more, but I'm sure snowboarding's amazing. I've never done that, but that looks incredible. Anyway, I couldn't get behind the, like, you know, this is the, you know, the only way or the best way, when a lot of our fans, I think we're like that. So when we broadened out and included split boarders and skiers, that felt more honest. And it's like, no, what we're doing is we're backcountry. And that's what's cool about this. So.
Nice.
Yeah. But our last film to me is where, you know, part of the reason we stopped is we kind of accomplished what we wanted to do. And we wanted to cover the beauty of backcountry skiing. We wanted to do some amazing expeditions. We wanted deep powder. We wanted good characters. And we wanted good production quality. And I feel like we provided all that in our last film. And that's part of the reason where we're just like, man, where do we go from here? And how much longer do we want to keep doing this? You know, I couldn't see myself doing it 10 years down the road. So, yeah.
It's funny. I was laughing when you said, oh, I can't stand watching those films. Like I, you know, solo and with bands, I've probably made almost 11 albums now. And I feel the same way about like my early records to the point where I'm like, how can I get those off of iTunes? It's awful. It's so bad. Yeah. It's just like, oh my God. It's like, I just had the worst taste and just,
Well, part of it is that we, you know, we were always behind the technology curve just for mostly for financial reasons. Like HD came out and we were still shooting in standard def for a couple of years. Yeah. And so the quality was just never, or not never, but wasn't quite there until the last several years. Yeah. But it seems
like maybe that was part of the appeal, kind of the DIY aspect to what you guys were doing.
Yeah, I think so. And everybody that watched, they're just like, hey, I could go do that with my buddies, or I, you know, it was relatable, a lot of it. And it was fun. It was how we, you know, we did it how we wanted to do it. It was amazing, Ron. And I loved every aspect. You know, we get to play all winter in film. And then I loved the editing and the production and even taking it on tour. You know, we'd do 40 cities every fall and just go into great ski towns and everybody's fired up. So it was all in all, I mean, it was an incredible gig. And
that's great.
Yeah.
First you told me one thing, then another in its place. Everybody makes mistakes, just don't lie right to my face. Not cool, not cool.
Although Noah calls the Wasatch and other Utah mountain ranges his physical home, it would be safe to call the big mountains of Alaska a spiritual home. Over multiple expeditions to Alaska, Noah has left his mark on a plethora of steep faces in the big ranges, including the Coast Mountains, the Revelations, the Chugach, and most notably, the Alaska Range. I asked Noah to talk about some of his most memorable trips to the Alaska Range, including descents of the West Ridge of the Moose's Tooth and a recent epic ski descent of the West Ridge and Raman Kular on the massive Mount Hunter.
Just to prove that you could hang, then why sabotage your own career, always falling on your face. Not cool. Not cool.
So I was at the bar in Park City, Utah, and I was there on locals night, and I just happened to be lucky enough to sit. I was sitting next to Jeremy Nobis, and he was drinking, and he just started going off on Alaska, and I'd never been, and he's like, he had no idea who I was, but he's like, you've got to go. He's all, put the credit card down, do whatever it takes. He's like, you've got to go to Alaska. I'd wanted to go anyway. I mean, it's there's nothing like it. But that Denali trip was actually my first Alaska trip. So it kind of started off with a bang and, you know, fell in love from there. And I was like, this is incredible. Because from, you know, expense to get there, it's pretty cheap from Salt Lake or anywhere in the U.S. You know, you're not going to get sick. You don't have to hire porters. There's no language barrier. The snow in general is as good as anywhere on the planet, but you can actually, you know, you can actually ski it. Obviously, the weather can be bad, but all in all, bang for your buck, there's just it's where skiing goes down,
right?
In a big way. I mean, yeah. So I was hooked. We went up there for Powder Whore Films, and we skied out of Haines for a couple of years, out of Thompson Pass. I did some personal trips to the Chugach. And went out, got out into the Revelations. So I just, you know, Alaska's just always been on the spring radar. Just like, that's where you go. And I've had so many great experiences. I've had a lot of downtime too. I've had a couple of runs where I sat in Talkeetna for 7 days in the rain.
The Talkeetna hang.
Yeah, I did. I think there was 10 days where no one flew in or out. Yeah. And I was glad I was in town in the rain instead of on snow in the mountain. But I took a trip up there to the Ruth Gorge with Andrew McLean. It was kind of his idea. And we went up there and conditions were really poor. And we just kind of skinned around in the flats looking at things. It was a beautiful place to be, but we didn't really ski much. But I saw the line on the Moose's Tooth and it freaked me out. And I was like, that looks like you could ski it. Which is that fun. I love that part of the game. You know, it's just that little, it's terrifying almost. It's not actually fun. Like, it's kind of that stuff that, you know, keeps you up at night and you're like, stop thinking about that. Stop thinking about it. Let it go. But, you know, I added it to the list as you're skiing and traveling. I just keep adding stuff to the list. And that was on there. And a key piece to me, especially in Alaska, and this happened on this last trip to Mount Hunter, is you really need more than one objective. You've really got to have a broad target, I believe, coming in. And because just weather's going to be different. Sometimes certain ranges are just not even in, you know, not a lot of snow or there's been too much wind. So I think really having a wide target and then deciding when you get up there, if you can, you know, where to go. So that's what we did for the Moose's Tooth. We were looking at skiing Mount Hunter, Mount Foraker, maybe Mount Hunter, and the Moose's Tooth. And there was weather up high, but weather looked good in the Ruth. So we flew in there. TAT, Paul dropped us off high up on the glacier because it was socked in down low. And we skinned down to the base and just camped there during a storm, like a light storm, dropped like 5-6 inches. And when the clouds cleared, we were right at the base of the thing and it looked really good. We decided to do a warm up on the Japanese couloir first on Baril. A French crew had skied that the day before and it was in really good shape. So that was a great warm up. And we got a good look at the Moose's Tooth from across the way. And yeah, things look good. We felt good. So we went for it the next day, put in the booter. There was a couple of guys from Wisconsin, I think, had gone up, made the traverse in onto the chute, and they came back down and they're like, oh, it's like 60 degrees up there, like super sketchy. And so we were like, oh man, shoot, I don't think it's that steep. So we went up, you know, and got to their booter and it was like a good 50 degrees. And we're like, ah, they're from Wisconsin. They don't know what slope angle is out there, of course. So that was pretty funny. It was perfect pitch for skiing and incredible snow. Just bluebird day. We got super lucky on that one. Tricky part was getting along the ridge, you know, and managing the staying away from the cornices, but still staying up on the ridge.
Yeah.
Cause that's a pretty nasty place to be.
Yeah. When you got back down, had it ever been skied before?
You know, I couldn't find any record and I didn't think it had. And when we got back and I started spraying about it on the internet, some snowboarders had done it like in the 90s.
Yeah.
So that was kind of cool. And that's the funny thing with first descents is like, it's always a first for you. Like it's always a first in those conditions, but there's something funny with the mental game of like, no one's done this before, you know? So we got the benefit of that, even though someone had been on it before,
but yeah.
It's a pretty cool ski line. Like, I think it's a fun one. Good 5,000 feet of fun terrain.
Yeah. Not to mention a fairly moderate classic climb.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, cool. Let's talk about this season. And it's funny cause this is how I initially was like, God, I need to like try and chat with this guy cause I follow you on Instagram and saw this kind of cryptic Instagram post of, you know, I put it together that you'd climbed and skied the West Ridge of Mount Hunter, which is incredible. Can you talk about how that trip came together and just tell the story of what went down on that trip for you?
Yeah, I'd love to. That was amazing. So my friend and ski partner, Adam Fabricant, we were scheming, trying to put something together and he had 2 weeks, in between trips. So we knew that wasn't a ton of time, but you know, with good weather, we could get something done. So we blocked out those dates and I flew up to Anchorage and we had a wide target. Like I mentioned, we were going to maybe go to the Wrangells or Tordrillos. We were looking at Mount Hayes, back to the Revelations. We had a large target because, you know, we'd been skunked the last few years in Talkeetna, just sitting in the rain. And we're like, we don't want to just sit in the rain or sit in a tent in snow. We want to ski something. So, as I got in Anchorage, the target narrowed, the Wrangells were looking real stormy and all the peaks there, the big peaks we wanted to look at is kind of committing and more, you need more than 2 weeks really to give those an honest effort. So we narrowed in and talked to Paul at TAT, and he said Mount Hayes was probably a little late for that. So we looked at Mount Foraker. That was our main goal. We got a permit for that, headed in there. Paul gave us a flyover, and it was just totally ice, looking at the Archangel Ridge on the north side.
Wow.
I attempted that a couple of times previously, and it looked horrible. We were all just like, nope, that's off the table. I mean, yeah. There was hardly any snow.
Interesting.
But we were in the area, and we were just like, well, we'll just drop it at base camp and ski around base camp, because it had been snowing a lot down low, you know, like the lower and mid elevations, basically all of May, which just was pounding snow. And on the flight in, we got to look at the base of the Raman couloir, which accesses the West Ridge. And it looked really good. It wasn't runneled, wasn't avalanched. So when we got in, we're like, that became our primary goal. We had in and out weather. So we skied Mount Francis in really good powder. We skied off of Peak 12, 200, fun line there. You know, even the mini golf there, these lower hanging fruit are great runs, like awesome descents. So we were having a good warm up and getting dialed. And then it looked like we had a good couple of 2 or 3 days weather. So we decided to go for Mount Hunter. No one had summited yet for the season, but there was a really experienced guide who was taken off with his client, and he'd actually left a couple of days before. So we were hoping he'd have put the booter in. We're like, maybe he's up there putting the booter in right now. Cause it had just snowed like another 6 to 8 inches. So it was funny, cause we skied Mount Francis during the day and we came back and it was clearing. And that night we packed up 3 days of food and fuel and skied out of camp at like midnight down the Cahiltna, wrapped around. And I don't know if you've seen the pictures, but there's a really bad ice fall, really bad Serac fall getting up into the basin to the base of the Raman. Mm-hmm. So we didn't even know if we could get past that. It's a mess, a big jumbled block. It kind of looks like a Tim Burton horror film of falling ice. So we're hiking through there in the middle of the night, tiptoeing, and we really went through there quite cleanly. I'm surprised. It was cool. We just had to climb one little steep section, haul our packs up, and then we were right at the base. So we dried all our stuff out the next day and just tried to rest, eat a ton of food, and then we headed up the Raman at 11. We started up at 11, and we could see the whole chute. The upper part looked like it might be icy, so that was pretty nerve-wracking. I don't like skiing ice, but we just, you know, thought we'd climb through what we could, and if we got turned around, so be it. But booting was good, and we took turns putting in the booter up the chute and then navigating onto the ridge. Once we got to the ridge, it was powder, and we used climbing skins. Have you seen those billy goat plates?
I haven't.
That you attach to your crampons. So it's a really cool little flotation device. So it just gives you more surface area. So cool. It's like a snowshoe, but it's metal. So you can do a little mountaineering with it.
Cool.
Yeah. So switching out with those, we were able to go up the ridge. We were kind of wishing we'd had more people in our party, because breaking that much trail for a party too is rough. But Adam's a fiend, man. He's just a madman. And I was feeling pretty worked, and he put in like solid 2,000 feet of trail breaking on his own. And I was just,
Damn. Yeah,
huffing and puffing, trying to keep up. But beautiful night. I mean, it doesn't get dark there, you know, it gets a little darker, but it's kind of this weird between sunrise, sunset for a long time, like felt like all night. And so we just had these beautiful views in every direction, perfectly calm. Not that cold. Really one of the more special days I've had in the mountains. I don't know if it was the whole effort and kind of the mind games that I'd been going through. I was pretty nervous about getting up there and about skiing ice and what we'd encounter. And a big thing about those peaks too, is you, at least being in the Wasatch and lower 48, you can't practice for that. You can't train for that. We don't have glaciers. We don't have blue ice. You know, we don't have stuff avalanching all around you. It just isn't that level of intensity and severity here. So it's pretty overwhelming. I think guys coming from Europe get a little bit of a better, you know, headspace, come from like a strong season skiing in Chamonix. It's much more similar.
Yeah.
But so I kind of had to work through some mental stuff, and Adam helped me out there and topped out. It was just beautiful and calm, and we could see everything. I could see the Moose's Tooth and We could see Mount Francis and the stuff we'd skied. We could see base camp. It was just, it was incredible. And we were glad we got to put in the booter and that the guide hadn't put it in for us. So just to be up there all alone was super cool. And kind of gets overlooked as a skiing mountain, because really, as far as we can tell, the Ramen is really the only feasible, reasonable ski route off right. of it. I mean, you could put together some other stuff, but it's kind of the most, makes the most sense. But other than that, it's just a bear of a mountain to get up on. And
that's huge.
Yeah. It's, yeah. And it felt much taller than the 14,000 feet. Yeah. We were pretty wrecked, but yeah, we had to do two rappels to get off the face near the summit. Cause it was blue ice up there, but then we were able to ski really good powder along the ridge. I mean, we were just laughing. We're like, this can't be happening.
Yeah.
You know, we were in our minds, we'd be skiing it, just scratching down it, you know, or it's, you're going to be skiing it, but it's not going to be good, but it was legitimately like good skiing and
amazing.
Yeah. Powder on the ridge. And then as we dropped into the face, which was the steepest part, probably 55 degrees, it was perfect corn. Just that your edge bites in and you're just not afraid because it's just too easy. You're just making your hop turns and skiing down, some of the most memorable turns I've ever had for sure. And that thing is long and consistently steep. It just doesn't end until you hit right into the glacier. So magical day. We were both like saying it was, you know, highlight of our skiing careers and lives. And fortunately, Adam got a little frostbite on his toes. So we had to bail on our trip, get him back into town. So cut short, but definitely sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I mean, it just sounds like it's kind of one of those things, you know, talking, you know, going back to those first lessons you learned as like a young man, seeing Hans Sari pass away. And it's like that changed things for you where you're like, you know, you can be the best skier in the world. You can do everything right, but sometimes the stars don't align. But that yeah. that makes experiences like what it sounds like you had on Hunter, where everything does come together. You might not ever be able to repeat something like that, you know?
And hearing some of the other descents, you know, it's been in much less ideal conditions. I think it's a really hard route to get in good conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, being south-facing. But that's what I love about the game is it's so much listening to the input around you and then making the right decision. Like I love that intense awareness and that heightened sense of like of engagement. And it can get overwhelming too, because we would, Adam and I were laughing because we had gone back and forth so much about what we were going to do and weather and this and that, you know, and getting your gear dialed. And there's so many of these little pieces that go in, like, should we bring a stove on route or no, you know, there's so many of these choices and decisions that make it happen or not, you know, and you get to decide all that and it has consequences. It means something. So I love that part of the game.
I lit out from defiance. I was pushing 22. Made it nearly to Chicago. Pulled my boots, had one through. Took a day job on the Gary docks, unloading the freight. And slept in the boarding house on Washington and 8. New Year's Day, I woke up to find that I've been wrong.
I have to say, I really enjoyed my chat with Noah. He's a charming guy that combines a witty and lighthearted sense of humor with a seasoned confidence that comes from years spent in the big mountains. Once again, I felt grateful for the opportunity to connect with a kindred spirit and make a new friend along the way. Before we ended our conversation, I asked Noah to talk about his future goals in the mountains and in life, and to reflect on the things that are important to him today.
I never punch the clock again. Headed south for Memphis, where the weather had cleared. And took up with a daisy who brewed a bitter beer. Loved her for a fortnight until it was said I'd have to pay the back rent or get out.
You've had a long career at this point in time. You know, what are some of the things that you've learned? And in thinking about that, what's important to you today in your life?
What have I learned? I feel like the older I get, the more I'm interested in unlearning. And I feel like a lot of the traps in the mountains and in life is when you think you know something. And then so much of it is just figuring out that you were wrong. So I'm kind of just about trying to, yeah, like unlearn things that I think I know about life in the mountains, and kind of opening things up and taking a broader view, if that makes sense, a broader perspective. Cause a lot of incidents or close calls I've had is because I thought I've known something, and like, oh, well, this won't slide because of this, or this can't happen here, or I've been here so many times. And with a broader, more open mind, you, I don't know, maybe escape some of those things, or I don't know, be more aware of everything instead of closing certain things off. And then things that I value more now. Yeah. Just quality experiences with partners. It's been hard finding good partners because, you know, a lot of my friends are older and married and have kids and jobs. And so that's been tricky to find people of my, you know, my age and that want to do the things I want to do. But I've been really lucky with some great folks. But yeah, appreciate those relationships and, you know, sharing those highs and the lows. Yeah, I just feel grateful, really feel grateful to have been able to, you know, have the support that I've had to do this and been lucky enough to do it for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some goals that you still have in the mountains and skiing? I know some people like to keep this stuff kind of close, so you don't have to give away all the stuff in your black book. But yeah. What are some objectives that you still would like to achieve, and what are some things that you'd like to do in your life in the future?
In the mountains, there's definitely still a big long tick list, but I'm kind of coming to the realization that just not enough time and not enough money. And I've got other passions and loves going on in my life. But I would love to ski the Wickersham, more a direct route, kind of similar to the Harvard route, but I think there's a little variation skiers left to that could go. That's like dreamline to me to be able to ski that much vertical off of that peak.
Hell so, yeah, dude.
So that's out there now. And then I started ticking off the 50 classic ski descents from North America, Chris Davenport's book. I kind of started that in earnest 2 years ago and about halfway through the book. And it's taken me to a lot of cool places that I never would have gone before. Ended up going back east and skiing in Tuckerman Ravine and Mount Huntington Ravine this year. And it was just totally different than anything I've ever, you know, skied. And it's just more of a scene and a social event, but so cool. And then, yeah, just random peaks in Colorado and all over. So that's been a fun project. I don't actually see finishing that because there's some real beasts in there that have only been skied once or twice. But it's a fun thing to dream about and to look forward to. But then other than that, I bought a piece of land just outside Salt Lake here, and I've kind of been developing that and looking to build a cabin and get old and drink tea and ski powder.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Noah's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his hard-earned backcountry wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. To find out more about Noah's latest mountain adventures, you can read some of his great blogs and other writings at noahhowell.com. We had musical contributions from my good friend, bandmate, and one of the great songwriters of our time, Tim Easton. You can find Tim's music at timeaston.com and any other place good tunes are sold, and I'll also leave some links in the show notes. Don't forget to review the show on Apple Podcasts, and if the Fernline adds value to your life, please consider becoming a monthly backer on Patreon. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can find more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fernline.